Hello and welcome to Two Friends Talk History, a podcast where two friends have a coffee and talk about history. My name is Sophia and I'm a public historian fascinated by the exploration of history from researchers, practitioners, academics, and more. In each episode, I invite a guest to discuss an aspect of history that they are involved with and why it matters in the section, So What? I'm so glad you're here joining me on this journey. As a way of thanking members for their support by joining us on Patreon, I offer members-only content, including extras like downloadable episode art, maps, and contextual images. Members have access to 100-word histories, downloadable learning materials, shoutouts, and more, all for the cost of a pint or a flat white a month. Sign up today at patreon.com/archaeoartist. Your support keeps this rickety wagon of dreams going. Well, I'm so pleased to introduce my good friend and guest, Alexandra Slucky. We met several years ago while on field school for the Aclanum Project in southern Italy, and we have shared so many adventures. I could not imagine a more knowledgeable and passionate pal to have a catch up with and discuss the archaeology of plants. Alex has a BA in politics and ancient history, which we will return to because that is a fabulous combination, from Mount Holyoke College. She flew across the world to complete a master's of museum and heritage studies from the University of Sydney, then once more into the fray for a master's of science in environmental archaeology at the University College London, where she is currently finishing that up. And this is where we catch up with her today. Alex, welcome to Two Friends Talk History. It is a pleasure to have you.
It is a pleasure to be here. I am a big fan. I've listened to all of the episodes.
Well, thank you. For somebody so young, you have such an incredible breadth of experience that, you know, I don't think we can contain it in one pod. So I think, you know, I'll be definitely having you back for some of our more reckless and wild adventure stories. But, you know, you have a lot of field experience from excavations as a student to working in commercial archaeology and museum collections management. And, you know, like they're all really aligned very well, but they're quite different paths, all of which very noble pursuits. But I've invited you here today to talk about archaeobotany, and mostly because anytime I have brought up your studies to anybody, their faces go from confused to fascinated and delighted. So I thought, like, perfect. This is the type of topic I think more people need to know about.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also the confusion is very real, because sometimes when I explain things to my mother for the 10th time, she's still very confused. So
how about we start then with, in general terms, what is archaeobotany?
So archaeobotany, also called paleoethnobotany, typically in North America, is a subfield of environmental archaeology that analyzes plant remains preserved within the soils of archaeological sites. It is one of the three subfields of environmental archaeology, which is a scientific discipline within archaeological sciences that reconstructs and studies the relationship between past societies and the environments they lived in. So it integrates biological, chemical, physical, and the social sciences by sort of looking at history, humanity, and science as a whole. And within this, archaeobotany is specifically focused on plants.
Awesome. So what you guys are doing really is you're taking seed and other sort of evidentiary remains and exploring the world through that lens. So like an art historian would explore, you know, the Netherlands through still lifes, as you know, through the lens of painting. You guys are doing it through the lens of seeds and other agricultural products and things like that.
Yeah. So when you're conducting field work, archaeologists encounter all sorts of material that can be analyzed: data, ceramics, human remains. And one thing that's actually found quite abundantly is plant remains. So seeds, charcoal, pollen, phytoliths, which are silica deposits that are in the form of plant tissues. And they can be seen by the naked eye. So those are called macroremains. So a peach pit, for example. You know, when you eat a peach, it's quite big, the peach pit. It preserves the same and it looks the same. It's just black.
Interesting. Okay.
So one of the most common things is people cook food, and in furnaces, fires, hearths, material can get scattered about and it gets charred. It gets preserved really well. And so that can be found quite abundantly on archaeological sites. Also in other areas like the road, it's really famous. They've done excavations along the Via Appia. People throw their apple seeds as they're having a snack as they walk to work. finds it ends up in the road, people sweeping at the entrances of houses. That's found abundantly all the time, even in bedrooms, you know, having a late night cheeky snack.
That's interesting. You're pointing to locations where it is not obvious to look, like if you're excavating and you're, you know, doing a section of road. I mean, of the things you expect to find, it probably isn't the case that it was always food remains, but you paint a very clear word picture of, you know, ancient Roman on his way to work or going in and out of town or, you know, a lady cleaning her domus, you know, sweeping it all out. Though I disagree with the practice of eating in one's bedroom, I do understand that this does happen.
Yes. And also within tombs, you know, people leave offerings and remains. So actually King Tut, when his tomb was excavated, they found tons of botanical material. I've actually had the pleasure of seeing the original like wreath that was laid on the sarcophagus. It's actually at the Economic Botany Collections at Kew Gardens. It's very fragile. You're not allowed to touch it, but you can look at it. And it's very beautiful. So yeah, people leave offerings all over the world. Mexico is very common because, you know, plants are beautiful and they're used in a variety of ways. Flowers can be decorative, but they also can be consumed. They can be eaten. They can be used in medicines, drugs, so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's fascinating. So on an archaeological site, I think we can all sort of imagine the general norms of, like, you know, excavation, you know, it's digging, it's sieving, it's, you know, documentation. Where does the archaeobotanist fit into that? That is the first port of call for gathering the remains that you're going to be analyzing in labs later on. How does the archaeobotanist work on an excavation?
So they can do two things. So I think all field archaeologists should have some base level of training of identifying fragile remains, whether they're very, you know, small animal bones or human remains, as well as botanical. So I think there needs to be a little bit of a delicate training at all levels.
Yeah.
And because of that, it will allow you, if you identify charcoal, for example, to handle the material very carefully and therefore excavate it and take a soil sample, which happens quite frequently when you're doing an excavation. They'll take soil samples along the way so they can do analysis in the soil. Oftentimes, soil can actually help us understand preservation conditions. So, for example, on commercial sites, when they're kind of tight on time and money, as always, they'll actually do a soil sort of sample. And so they can check what's the level of preservation. So like Edinburgh, for example, has notoriously acidic soils. So they know that sometimes when they're going to do a dig, they're not going to find a lot of material. Because the soils just eat away at things. And that's just sort of the natural processes. And so soil is probably the first thing that you have to start with. But always taking soil samples is a common occurrence. It's a common occurrence in geology. It's a common occurrence in petrology. It's not just archaeology, but in archaeology, we specifically use it to undergo a process called flotation, which is basically a process of buoyancy as a technique to separate materials of different densities. So like sieving, you basically sieve material, dirt, through a water sample, through a screen, oftentimes just like a window screen. You can buy them pretty cheaply.
So if you're like panning for gold, like in the Yukon, something like that.
Exactly. Like that is actually the problem. I used to tell my sister that it was sort of like a pasta strainer for dirt.
You're getting rid of
the rocks, because rocks, you know, destroy things. You don't need rocks unless you love them. We love geology here. Yeah. So you can separate lighter material. So seeds and charcoal, and often sometimes light shells will float. And then heavier material, such as bone fragments or rocks, or will sink. And so you actually get to separate material. So that makes it much easier to then collect. And then once you get there, you do the process of sorting. So this is typically like you're going to sort. Seeds look different than charcoal. Charcoal is wood and seeds are plants. And you want to keep those fields separate because they represent different things. So wood can be anything for, you know, lighting your fire in your kitchen so that you can make a tasty soup for dinner, to building your house. Versus seeds could be, you know, the residue from cooking a dinner or grinding something, or actually they go through the body and they are there. They come out the other end and they are often found in latrines. I mean, that is yeah, a very absolutely. Frequent place. And it seems kind of gross, but at the same time, it's very part of the human experience.
Well, and it's interesting that the places, like obviously like human body functions are associated with every level of taboo. But in the longer view of history, they provide us with so much more information about the health and wellness of communities that are even being used today. Like I recall some work being done in Ephesus based in different neighborhoods. They were looking at what types of diseases and other things were localized to certain neighborhoods, and then seeing if they could, you know, develop patterns and stuff like that from these samples. But as well, recently, because of COVID, they have been doing that same process, like examining through samples, like what is the percentage of, I guess, infection based on stool samples. So it's a resource. And yeah. I'm not going to stick my nose up at it.
Well, also, I think actually you bring up a really incredible point with COVID. Pestilence and famine is very difficult to study mm-hmm. in the historical and the archaeological record because it's an absence of data. Because especially for historical documents, you know, when you're dying of the bubonic plague or yep. Spanish influenza or COVID-19, you're not really focused on journal writing.
Not so much.
And so you can, within the absence, if you have a lack of material, that actually can be something very interesting. And in archaeobotanical studies, we call it absence-presence studies. So if you expect something to be there in the record that is historically well-documented, such as like a grain for bread making, and it's not,
yeah,
something's off.
Yeah, the food systems of networks have changed or interrupted.
No one's plowing the fields because they're all dead.
Yeah, absolutely. So that brings me to an interesting impact with archaeobotany within understanding, you know, the daily lives of ancient people and trading in the world. Like, perfect segue to that. To me, it seems that this type of study offers a very nuanced but very important key between the different trade networks and different cultures and how people were coming together in ways that aren't documented necessarily. Like we can infer and we do know, even without written sources or images or anything, that trade has been happening across the world for forever. But in what form that took and what the impact was is quite hard to quantify or understand without something you can trace back or something you can analyze the spread. And it sounds to me like this is, through archaeobotany, we can get a huge sense of what the ancient world was doing with food and thus cultural shared practices and customs that were spreading. And
yeah, definitely. And not just for food. I mean, for medicine is a huge commodity that's traded. Textiles. I mean, textiles are made often of plant materials.
Of course, yeah.
Plant or animals, flora and fauna. And so that is quite big. Also perfume, cosmetics. Mm. This is the thing. Drugs are a very taboo subject, alcohol, but they play a very important role, particularly with religion and accessing different planes of understanding and existence. So these were all very valuable materials. Building material is another thing. So I think there's quite a lot of depth. And I think when you're on an archaeological site and you're looking at seeds and they're kind of weird looking, and you're sort of, you have to kind of broaden your imagination and realize that when you're looking at this, it's not just the seed, it's understanding the greater ecosystem that is connected to the object. And so, you know, as archaeology is the study of the material culture of the past, archaeobotany, environmental archaeology, is the study of the biocultural material of the past.
I like
and
that.
And because, yeah, actually, I think there's a quote that starts the introduction to environmental archaeology textbook, which is very fundamental. And it says, the human past cannot be understood without integrating the full range of evidence contained within archaeological sites and recognizing the cultural systems are inextricably linked to their environments.
Yeah.
And I think that's really beautiful because to me, people are products of their environments, but they also shape the environments in which they live. And so for trade, I mean, that's exactly what it is you are trading something that is valuable to your environment for someone else that wants it, or you are looking for something that you don't have that is a reflection on your environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the creation of identity and things like that can be done in so many different ways. and community identities, local identities, regional identities, and they become broader and broader or more narrow, depending on what the pressures and opportunities are around them. What's so interesting about the construction of identity in the ancient world, as is in the modern, is somebody else comes upon it and they integrate it, synthesize it, syncretize it. I think especially because you mentioned clothing and makeup and perfumes, you know, the beauty industry has to be such a huge driver for trade and change because, you know, it's not just women and men want to be beautiful and ornately dressed and, you know, show their status, represent their culture, but use the status symbols of another culture to do so. So it's fabulous.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also, it's connected back to health and medicine and sanitation. Mm-hmm. And these are things that are very important. And I think just because we're in such a weird time with health is such on the forefront of the mind. I mean, it's the constant reminder of your health and how you take care of your body and what you put into your body or put on your body or adorn it is fundamental to your well-being, mm-hmm. whether psychologically, mentally, physically. And these are connected to biological products of the world, you know, in the past and in the future and in today.
Can you give an example or two of some of the wild plant stories that you've come across that you think people will be interested in? Because I think from just conversations you and I have had, what we think people use plants for is not always the case. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yes. So I have just finished, or I'm about to finish, my master's dissertation looking at Central Asian archaeobotany. I'm very passionate about the Silk Roads at different points since it was very long and encompassing. And one of the crops that I find fascinating that is not really thought about in the modern world is rhubarb. So when you think of rhubarb, yeah. So when you think of rhubarb, what do you think of?
Pie.
Exactly. So rhubarb is a leafy vegetable that the stalks are consumed. You can't actually eat the leaves because they have an acidic quality that is actually quite toxic to humans. So the stalks are basically used in pies and sugaring processes, jams. It's very good as a filler to kind of add abundance to a dish. But rhubarb is actually a famous medicinal plant.
What? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm listening.
So rhubarb has been domesticated. It's a cultivated plant. It has different species, but it typically comes from Central Asia. It's known, or the culinary version of it is known to be domesticated out of Tibet. It is used as a laxative, as a stomach ailment. So typically the stems were ground and dried, or dried and ground, and they would be made into essentially what I call the original version of Pepto-Bismol.
Interesting.
But also what was fascinating about it is it grows wonderfully in the steppe and in China, but it doesn't grow super well in Europe, but it can. But it's not the medicinal rhubarb that was really desired. And so it was heavily traded in the medieval period, particularly leading up to the bubonic plague. And there is increasing research that the rats and gerbils that spread bubonic plague from the fleas actually traveled in rhubarb plants traded along the Silk Road to Europe.
Rhubarb, yeah. Betrayer.
Yeah. Yes, but what's also really fascinating is there's a great book called Rhubarb, the Wondrous Drug, and there's a line in it that says that there's no medicinal plant that has perplexed and frustrated Europeans more. I mean, there's so many documents from the medieval period of pharmacists and doctor surgeons who wanted to have access to this plant because it's painless to take, it doesn't have any side effects, and it works super great.
Huh. But it was hard to get really their hands on.
It was hard to get their hands on. But I thought about this really kind of further. And I remember there was a line that my professor of Silk Roads, Tim Williams at the Institute of Archaeology, said, and he said, if the Silk Road was not called the Silk Road, it could have been called the Rhubarb Road.
That's fabulous. But
it doesn't roll off the tongue, I think, as sort of intoxicating as the Silk Road. But it was traded quite abundantly. And I just think that's really fascinating. But it's also fascinating because I think, especially in North America, a lot of people think it's just from North America because it actually grows really well. But no, it's from Central Asia, as many wonderful plants are from.
Interesting. So I love the idea of the Rhubarb Road, and I think we should maybe try a rebrand. Yes. Obviously, silk is important, and I'm not diminishing silk for anyone who studies silk. But
it's not vegan. Silk's not vegan.
No, it's not vegan. And I am fascinated by the idea that rhubarb would be something you could take for all sorts of stomach and internal ailments. I might have to try and add more rhubarb to my life. Like,
yeah, I think also, I think it's really funny that it is commonly talked about as a laxative. And, you know, that sort of invokes sort of embarrassing bodily and, you know, we've talked about the taboos of the body, but there was a lot of food that could really hurt you.
Yeah, sure is.
I mean, people ate rotting meat. The Romans are famous for disguising meat with abundance of spices that was rotting. And actually, if you can consume so much, if you consume so much, it can make you quite sick. And so having a medication that can alleviate stomach ailments and maybe rid you of toxic substances, I think would be quite valuable.
Yeah. Well, and there's one period of the Middle Ages always resonates in my mind with is dysentery. Everybody dies of dysentery. And so, I mean, it's a weird thing to like directly associate with a historical period, but oh my goodness, it is. And yeah, I can imagine that the desire for rhubarb would be strong.
Yeah. So that's, so that's one of my favorites. I mean, there's so many plants that I think are really fascinating. But one thing that I think particularly interests me is something called the post-Columbian exchange. Mm. And so this is the movement of New World or the Americas foods to Europe and then Asia.
Yep.
And one thing that people don't always think about is chili pepper, the capsicum. There are 5 species and they all come from the Americas. So all spicy food in the world, all spicy cuisine comes from the Americas.
Interesting. I would not have guessed that.
Yeah. So Sichuan peppercorns, which come from the Sichuan region of China, are probably the closest in terms of physical feeling. They create that numbing feeling, but they're not quite the same. It's a different kind of chemical enzyme. Yeah. So all spicy food actually, or the pepper, you know, spicy food that uses chili peppers.
Yeah.
It's a direct result of the colonization of the Americas.
That is fascinating. And what an impact it has made.
Oh yeah, no, it's just, I mean, I don't think people quite understand the depth of how New World America, you know, America, as I say, North and Central and South America and the Caribbean, these foods radically changed the world. I mean, corn is maize. It's the most grown crop in the world next to wheat. They
What about soy? Where does soy fit into that? Because I know it's huge.
Soy is from China.
No, I mean, in terms of like, like large crop outputs, I think like soy has to be up there. Like,
I think it's number 4. So I think it's either wheat first and then corn. So maize. And then I think 3rd is potatoes. Is a sort of like starchy food up there.
Legitimate. Yeah. Potatoes are delicious. Yeah.
They are delicious. Barley is very high up there. Not so consumed as much as a food, but barley is fundamental to beer making.
Yes.
2-row naked barley is needed in the malting process. Barley is also very crop and drought resistant. So it grows really well in areas that have harsher climates. And so it's really important for places like Russia because it can handle the winters. And so it's, you know, those are crops that are very, you know, important in, you know, the Himalayas, for example, too.
Nice. So just to take it back for a second, you know, you studied classics, you've worked in commercial archaeology. From those perspectives, you've obviously kind of not shifted gears entirely, but you've kind of entered a different discipline. What do you find the most interesting aspect of the study of this field? Like, what if you were to come across somebody who had an interest in plants in their undergrad, what's your pitch to like why this is so interesting?
So for me, a really big dilemma I had in archaeology and history is that I was constantly being pressured to focus a region, a place, a time period. And this didn't really work for me because, as I've told you, I love the Silk Road. I love the Romans. I'm obsessed with ancient Peru and the Andes. I think Australia is magnificent. I'm obsessed with it everywhere. It's really problematic. There's so many things that fascinate me. And so I struggled with focusing. And what I realized is that I needed to find a skill, not a place or a time.
Yeah.
And so archaeological sciences offer you an alternative if you are like me and you just love so many things. And so I think the pitch for me is it gives me the unique and wondrous opportunity to have diversity in my research. And I think for the academics that I really admire, and my advisor, who I actually went to UCL to study with, Professor Dorian Fuller, is his CV, his publication record, spans the entire globe across time. It's spectacular, from the Neolithic Revolution to today. And I think for me, he is not bound by any one thing. He rather studies something that I like to call universal but personal. I am fascinated by things that are part of the human experience that all living creatures need, but is yet very personal to every place or time or person or region. And to me, studying plants is fascinating because I love food. I love studying alcohol. I love studying medicine. Food and flavor and taste is very unique to every person. We all have our own tastes and flavors and cultural influences in regions and time periods, but yet we all have to eat. Oh, no, for me, I just think that there's something that's very beautiful about that. And also, I've never not been able to have a conversation with anyone on Earth because everyone loves talking about food.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking, like, that's an elegant sort of summary as to why this resonates with you. Like, the if you are a person who cares about people, then understanding some of where our traditions come from, some of what keeps us bound to each other, and how we're different, but different in ways that are not barriers. We're different in ways that are connecting and interesting and, you know, influence each other. And there is probably nothing quite like food that brings people together, which is probably why my mind keeps associating archaeobotany with, like, yes, you know, there are the other elements like medicine and clothes and things, but I'm like, but food, because you know, it's just such a good bridge between everything. And I think a global perspective, which is what this study seems to offer you, is it is liberating in its scope.
Definitely. And I think also it gave me a sense of purpose to connect to other subjects that I feel are very morally important to me. So I have a deep interest in politics, but I don't want to be a politician. Mm. And I have a deep interest in physical geography, but I don't want to be a geographer or a geologist. I want to encompass these trainings into my practice, but I don't want to be confined by one research career. And for me, when I study food, it has direct implications to studying climate change and global food production and economics and the structure of the world. I mean, there is nowhere on Earth today that humans have not touched. There is plastic in the depths of the ocean. There is trash everywhere. And it's really tragic, but it also lets us know that humans are very dominant in the world today, but they've not always been. And so I think archaeobotany and environmental archaeology, which encompasses zooarchaeology and geo, so animals and then sediments and soils, I think these three research disciplines as a united front can offer quite a lot to the climate change research debate. And in fact, I think we're underutilized. You know, people keep talking about the Anthropocene, is this discussion about the modern human epoch where humans are the dominant life force, which is the transition from the Holocene, the dawn of civilization, the human start. And there's been a big discussion about when did this date happen? And there's sort of four dates that are proposed. And the one that's sort of agreed upon by the UN is July 16th, 1945.
Oh.
Do you know what happened? July 16th, 1945?
Not specifically, no.
It's the first atomic bomb tested.
Ah, right. That's a weird place to start it at.
Well, no, because so what they do is they test the ice cores.
Oh, right. Of course.
They see chemical spikes and nothing on record spiked more than 1945 because of the impact from the atomic bomb. But the other dates that are proposed are the start of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. And in the Roman period, too, there was...
Actually, the next date is 1610. Mm. 1610 is the lowest date of carbon because so many people died in the Americas from the impact of smallpox that the forests became reclaimed because there was no one to manage them. It sucked basically chemical properties out of the sky and it dropped the temperature and it created the ice age. And this radically shifted the impact of climate on Earth. And then the next date is, so the Roman date is considered the end of the Roman warring period. That is one. It's definitely one of the impacts of the end of the Roman Empire, of amongst many, amongst many textbooks we could discuss. But that one's less flagged because it's more focused on Western Europe versus 1610 affects everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you start seeing impacts in like Indonesia and Iceland and the Hawaiian Islands. I mean, everywhere was impacted. And then the next date is about 10,000-11,000 years ago when they domesticated crops.
Interesting.
Yeah. So because that really radically changed everything. And these dates are important. And like, I don't think there's one date. I don't think you can be like, this one date where America dropped an A-bomb and really messed with things is the reason the world's a horrible place. Like, feel free to argue that. I don't think anyone will fully fight you, but it's a human accumulative thing. And I think these dates are really important. And one thing I always see in this climate debate is there, you know, there's all these climate scientists and politicians and lawyers, and they're like, well, the long-term impacts of the human, you know, destruction on the planet. And I'm like, okay, but you need someone who can study the long-term impacts. Mm-hmm. You need someone who has the laboratory field and methodological skills to analyze that data of the long-term impacts. And I think that's where environmental archaeology plays a very important role.
Awesome. That's fabulous. All right. So this brings us to the section of the show historically called So What? But more broadly, this is where I want to ask like the big question. Why does this matter? What about, you know, ancient food production or the study of archaeobotany or the trade in ancient medicines or anything we've kind of touched on today? Why do you think this should matter more to people, or what would you like the public to kind of know about it?
So there's an immense complexity to how the world is the way it is today. And we can track the beginning of civilization being like coalesced societies, not hunter-gatherers, to the domestication of crops and animals. So at the end of the day, the greatest focus is survival and eating. And if civilization is based on being able to feed a lot of people and thus blossom culture, I think archaeobotany offers a fundamental way to study the basics of the human experience and the human story of civilization, that everything that we have attributed to culture today, music, art, architecture, cuisine, fashion, so many interesting, beautiful things started with, can we feed our people?
Yeah.
And how?
I agree. I think without securing resource, without having enough to focus on other things like painting, sculpture, all this other stuff. And I'm thinking at a very like early stage.
Mesopotamia.
Yeah. Kind of yeah. Like deep, deep history, old school. You just don't have the resources to be the artisan creator. You don't have the ability to just specialize in one potentially activity. Now, that is not to say that people did not do a ton of different jobs. Of course, you know, we are living in the generation of the side hustle. Mm-hmm. So we get it.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, I think that's really nicely put.
I think also on a personal level, for me, I'm always passionate about highlighting the role that women have played in the contribution of world history and in archaeology. And I mean, it's a little like dramatic, but man hunter, female gatherer, there is some truth that women and the gathering of crops and, you know, that agricultural management is fundamental to the survival of all of us. And I think women truly bring life in the sense that they make life, but they also create life through management of agricultural materials. And I think that's really extraordinary. And every time I do archaeobotany, part of me feels that I'm being able to tell the story of millions of women who came before me, who cultivated the landscape of the world today and made it so that I can exist in the world today. And I think that makes me very proud, makes me feel very humbled. And I think it feels really feminist to me. And I'm like very for that.
I love that. I love this for you. I love this for us. This is wonderful. And you know what? You're totally right. I think the voices of women in history are so hard to pick out sometimes. Interestingly, a lot of times women have served as, you know, traditional memory holders. We train, we teach, we communicate, we share knowledge, we don't hoard it. Like, this is something very, I feel, representative of women throughout history. And that certainly would translate to knowledge about the uses of different fauna and flora for all sorts of things, as well as rhythmic seasonal planting and harvesting. Like, you and I are big supporters and lovers of the Chthonic goddesses in ancient, ancient mythology.
Make Cybele great again.
Yep. I'm here for Persephone, Demeter. Like, there's
always,
there's so many interesting touchstones with, you know, women's work and agriculture. So,
yeah. And I think to me, my favorite myth was always in Incan mythology in Peru in the Andes. Pachamama is Mother Earth, and her womb is the entrance of a cave. And there's one that's near the Sacred Valley, near Ollantaytambo. And out of her womb comes these salt mines, and then it flows into this valley of agriculture, and there's still like terrace agriculture there. It's really spectacular. And the kind of traditional idea is that, you know, she brings life to the world through her womb, and she makes abundance. And I, for me, that was so meaningful as like a teenager on the cusp of my like coming into my, you know, my adulthood and my womanhood, and being like, yeah, women are important. I am part of that narrative. And
yep.
I think for me, there's something that's very feminine and feminist about environmental archaeology, not to mention some of the greatest archaeobotanists have been women. I mean, Naomi Miller at Penn is exceptional, and Deborah Pearsall and Christine Hasdorf. I mean, these exceptional women who are all alive today, and they have played fundamental advancements in the methodology of the science. And whether they did it for feminist reasons or not, or scientific or anything intellectual, they, as women, as botanists, as archaeobotanists, as archaeologists, paved the way. And so for me, I actually found entering archaeobotany as a woman incredibly supportive. I find archaeology still a little bit of a bros club. I mean, I can excavate as well as any guy. I've done it in multiple heat waves. But working with female archaeobotanists, my first mentor, Dr. Robin Veal at Cambridge, she didn't talk about it's very inclusive for women.
Yeah.
And all the other archaeobotanists in my master's program this year were women. And even though my professor was male, he was incredibly supportive and is inclusive and supportive to female pursuits.
Awesome.
And his first doctor. Yeah, his first doctoral student, Dr. Ruth Pelling, who's the director of archaeobotany for English Heritage, did exceptional advancements back in the day, and he was very supportive from the beginning. So I think it's it's a great job if you're a girl in archaeology.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Alex. I think you've, in a lot of ways, kind of taken us on a bit of a journey about how exciting the field can be and the outer reaches of where it can take you. And it really is kind of as you can conceive it, you can define it and find the pathway through it that is interesting to you. So, I mean, like a call to arms for new archaeobotanists, I hope, you know, there's more out there than just ceramics, which are stunning. And I'm here for ceramics, but like, there are other things to study.
But what went in the ceramics?
Exactly. That's the question. Why build the ceramic? What were you holding?
What soup was in that bowl?
Or what wine were you feasting with? So yeah, this has been a fascinating talk, and I am so grateful for your time and your obvious passion and expertise. It is a pleasure to speak with you always, but a delight to have you on today.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us as we explored these stories together. Please give Two Friends Talk History a review on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or Spotify, or whatever platform you use. It's easy to do. And if you want to give a rating under the episode details, it helps so much to gain visibility and get listed in other countries. So that would be amazing. You can also check out the Instagram for Two Friends Talk History, or you can check out my website, www.archaeoartist.com, or hit up our Patreon. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.